It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with The Splendid Table. Stone broke. Our first Christmas, and there wasn't a penny for gifts. But we did have flour, so it was bread for presents. And we let everybody know what was coming. Well, that holiday was amazing. Everybody gifted something they dreamt up. There was an ornament carton filled with red apples. One friend made a milkbone dog biscuit with our dog's name in sparkles. Another showed up with old-fashioned pomanders. So do I remember the Christmas of the Beautiful Watch? Sure. But that first Christmas, the one where dysfunction stayed outside in the snow, that's the one. Holiday spirit coming your way this hour on The Splendid Table. This episode of The Splendid Table is brought to you by the new 2011 Hyundai Equus. Discover the Hyundai Equus, the new premium luxury sedan from Hyundai, offering first-class refinement and features, including an iPad equipped with the Equus Owner's Manual app.
This week's Splendid Table is a repeat of an earlier broadcast.
Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by American Public Media. You know, like every other profession, food has its slew of awards. The best restaurant, the best cookbook, the best chef. But one that's missing is the best instigator, the person who has inspired the most non-cooks to step up to the stove. Well, right up there with Julia Child would be Emeril Lagasse. He's got the Pied Piper gene. Emeril, good to have you back with us.
I am so delighted, Lynn. Thank you so much for having me back.
You know, I'm remembering something, and I don't know if you do. The first time we met was in 1993, and you had one restaurant then. It was Emeril's, as I remember, in New Orleans.
That's correct.
And I came for lunch with some friends, and we started to talk, and we were there the whole afternoon listening to you because you talked about how you wanted to learn about hearts of palm, the ingredient that normally comes in a can, and that you had brought in an entire palm tree and laid it out on the floor of the restaurant, and you and your whole staff, and I never forgot this, you said, we learned to love the palm tree.
That's a very true story. I remember not only the day, but I remember the table. You sat at table 36.
Oh, my goodness.
And you were in position one. And I remember first talking to you about risotto, and then we started talking about this hearts of palm and how every night at the restaurant, and still today, 20 years later, we have pre-meal where we talk about food, we talk about wine, the customer.
Right.
And part of those days was a huge education process going on with the staff, who I'm proud to say 20 years later, most of them are still with me. Huh. And that particular week, we were breaking down the entire palm tree to show the staff where the palm came from, then how to cure it, and then how to marinate it, and then using the different pots. And then we featured it the coming weekend on the menu.
By the way, I think if you'll pardon me the honesty, I think I fell a little bit in love with you during that. No, because the curiosity got me. You know, very few people admit this kind of excitement. What is shaping your cooking these days? I mean, what are the most recent influences on what you do?
Well, this time of the year, I start getting these flashbacks of my mom, which is Portuguese cooking. So, you know, all those types of bacalhau dishes, the salt cod dishes, salt cod fritters, caldo verde, which is a kale soup that's pretty hearty. You know, her mother sardas, which are a Portuguese donut that's fried. All of those things start coming back to me, you know, her spiced pork chops that she would do with hot peppers. I know. My mouth is watering already.
As you're saying this, yeah, I'm getting very, very hungry.
Also, I had a trip this past summer to Spain, and I have a lot of curiosity about Spanish food, the regions of Spain.
Mm-hmm.
I spent some time more in the Gallic part of it a couple of years ago, and that was very interesting to me, where tapas and, you know, very close to France. But this time I was more towards Madrid on, Barcelona.
It's southern part of the country.
Yeah, it has my curiosity. I don't know if it's because there's lots of similarities to New Orleans, you know, jambalaya, paella, et cetera,
yeah,
et cetera.
Yeah.
But I really respected the fact that they respected the water, and then they respected the product that was coming out of it. It was fascinating. Simplicity. I'm trying to be of the school, Lynn, right now, that less is more. So it's not easy to do, but
I can't resist this. Less BAM?
less BAM. Just, you know, less protein and more other components, like more vegetables.
But, you know, going back to the food of your mom, what was Christmas Eve like when you were a kid? What did you eat?
Italians celebrate with seven fishes on Christmas Eve. And my mom never got close to seven, but there was a lot of seafood. So, you know, as I said earlier, bacalhau, salt cod.
Right.
She would do two different types. One, she did with these very, very thin layered potatoes with lots of fresh parsley and sort of a light, spicy sort of tomato sauce. And then one was layered with more of a custard with a lot of onions and garlic, which was really delicious. And as I mentioned earlier, she would do some sort of pork, either with a roast or a local butcher that made all of the chorizo and linguiça.
Yeah, the sausages.
Would do this special cut, this what they called chorizo meat. And she would take that. It was kind of marinated and spicy. And she would cook that down, sort of roasted it with potatoes and mostly winter vegetables that, you know, she'd get her hands on, like turnips and rutabagas and that kind of thing. One of the dishes, too, that she made was a thing that she called favish. And a couple of cookbooks ago, I finally put her on the spot to do the recipe with me and cook it with me so that I could copy it and put it in the cookbook because I want it to be around forever because it's so delicious. But it's basically just fava beans, and she uses dry fava beans that she soaks. And it's stewed down with a little bit of ground pork and tomato product and a lot of parsley and garlic, and it's delicious.
It sounds fabulous, and it sounds like she really did shape your cooking, didn't she?
Yeah, and we still have fun even now, you know, together. she's a couple of doors down, so we're always experimenting with each other, sending things over. I'm sending things to her. She's sending things to me. It's a wonderful cooking and mother-son relationship.
You're very lucky, Emeril.
I know.
Hey, thank you for talking with us.
Oh, Lynn, thank you so much for having me, and I can't wait to talk with you again soon.
Well, and you have a great holiday, sir.
You too.
Take care. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
You can see Emeril in his series, Emeril Green, on the Planet Green Network. Now, for that soup we talked about, Emeril's new style caldo verde, just go to the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, take a look at our new holiday page. There's advice from some of our favorite guests, book picks from the whole crew, homemade gift ideas, and a variety of menus and recipes. It's all there, guys, splendidtable.org.
Oh, Christmas tree, oh, Christmas tree, how lovely are your branches. Oh, Christmas tree, oh, Christmas tree, how lovely are your branches. And beauty green, they'll always grow through summer sun and winter snow. Oh, Christmas tree, oh, Christmas tree, how lovely are your branches.
The holidays can bring out the best and the worst in the DIY department. Inspiration is lovely, but execution can be quite an adventure, as radio producer Diane Bach details.
Should you ever happen to get the crazy idea to turn to your 8-year-old son and say, "Hey, sweetie, how'd you like to draw up a plan for your dream fortress and we'll construct it out of gingerbread?" Well, first of all, don't. Not unless, 1, you are possessed of infinite patience. 2, you have a very supportive partner who's up to the challenge as well. Someone with construction, drafting architecture experience is a definite bonus. 3, you've carved out a block of time. We're talking at least 12, closer to 15 hours of active work time. And 4, know that this behemoth that your wonderfully creative, artistic child has designed and that said partner has mapped out the template for is going to require massive amounts. We're talking 5 batches of gingerbread dough. And yes, use the recipe that calls for eggs. That way your dough will come out nice, soft, and pliant, not freaking dry and crumbly like the first 2 batches you measured, mixed, chilled, and attempted to, cursing the whole way through, roll out to the shape of 4 fortress walls, to say nothing of the 4 towers to the fortress. And the realization that we need 16 of those pieces? And now it's freaking 11:30 p.m. You've been at this rolling out, cutting, and baking off pieces stage for 5.5 hours. And you've just come to the realization you do not have enough dough. This is throwing a bit of a monkey wrench into the plan. More dough means kneading butter at room temp and pulling out the KitchenAid, hauling out and measuring all of those dry ingredients again. Cleaning up all of the accoutrements above steps will require. The overnight chilling time means you can't finish this until the next day, which is a day you have devoted to other commitments, not the least of which is that pesky detail known to the majority of us as going to work, which is the subject of at least another essay, if not an anthology. But I digress. You take a deep breath. Pour a glass of chilled white wine, keep the iPod going on shuffle mode, and get to softening that butter in the microwave. The sooner you get this batch done, the sooner your head will hit the pillow. So, flash forward to the next day. The dough rolls out and bakes like a dream. Wonderful smell of gingerbread, which you actually now have the ability to notice, fills the house. It's a team effort putting the castle together. 2 adults for the actual construction, plus 1 child in charge of supervision and decoration. And somehow it all gets done. Of course, the best and funnest part being the decorations. Go crazy. Go nuts. 1,000,000 diabolical gummy bear soldiers. And for each M&M on the castle, 2 down the hatch. And so, from the dark depths of despair of the previous night, facing the challenge of producing yet more of the blasted infernal gingerbread dough, you look across the massive expanse of the castle to the face of your child at this magical, wonderful, never-to-be-repeated, Santa Claus is coming to town for real. And oh, by the way, I just lost a tooth, age of 8, and he looks at you with such wonder, happiness, and oh my God, Mama, I can't believe how huge it is. We made this giant, magnificent, candy cane-filled castle with a catapult. Was it worth it? You bet it was.
Oh my gosh, Mama, it's so cool. It's just huge. I can't believe that we did it. It's so magnificent. It's just, it has a catapult, it has everything. It's so awesome.
For the next project, radio producer Diane Bach will commemorate a recent trip to New York City to see Bruce Springsteen by constructing Madison Square Garden entirely out of gingerbread with her 10-year-old. Now, one DIY project that will not get out of hand is concocting your own spice blend. Now, the idea is a blend of spices that can be cooked into a lot of different recipes or sprinkled on a dish as a final flavoring. So that way, it works for non-cooks, too. You attach a tag to each container with the name of the blend and ideas for using it. Now, you could do a West Indian spice blend of spices like allspice, ginger, and cinnamon mixed with coriander, basil, and thyme. Another one is our perennial crossover spice. It's the combination of cumin, coriander, and black pepper, and it shows up in so many cuisines that we decided to just mix it up and have it handy. Now, to invent your own spice blends, think about the spices that you use together all the time, and then start blending in tiny amounts, tasting as you go. And when you get a blend you like, give it a name, make notes on how it's used, and you've got another raft of quick gifts. Now, you can find the recipes for the West Indian Spice Blend and Crossover Spice on the website, splendidtable.org. Coming up, the gingerbread saga continues with writer Augustine Burroughs and A Cuban Christmas Feast. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. This episode of The Splendid Table is brought to you by the new 2011 Hyundai Equus. Now, for the last few weeks, we've asked you to take a poll on our website. Well, now we've got some results. First, wine. 71% of you prefer red wine over white, usually spending less than $15 on that red. And two-thirds of you tend to buy American wine. But 14% of you said you mainly buy Australian wine. Interesting. And what was your favorite kitchen tool? Without a doubt, you love your knives, as long as they're well-maintained. Well, thanks to Hyundai and the new 2011 Equus for helping us with this survey. You can add your voice to the survey at podcastinsidersurvey.com. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. I'd hate to see the innocent gingerbread house become a symbol of fantasy run amok. I mean, it would be like hearing that the sugar plum fairy hangs out with Lindsay Lohan. But Nemesis is written all over that gingerbread thing. The memoir writer Augustine Burroughs took his shot at his gingerbread fantasy when he was 8. His new book is all about gingerbread house season. It's You Better Not Cry, Stories for Christmas. Augustine, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Augustine, this book is all about Christmas experience, but there's one tale that the cook in me just loves. You were a kid, and you tried to make a gingerbread house. How did that come about?
I did, and I failed miserably. You know, I saw a picture in a magazine of a gingerbread house, and of course, this was, you know, these are the last few days. This was the countdown.
Right.
Everything I did had to relate to Christmas, so here's one thing I haven't done, build a gingerbread house.
And you're how old at this point?
I was about 8, maybe 7 or 8.
Uh-huh, okay.
You know, I considered the recipe to be just a helpful suggestion, an idea, you know, follow it or don't follow it, and I didn't. So, you know, instead of whatever, molasses, which who'd even heard of, and all, you know, I just added allspice and coffee grinds, or not grinds, ground coffee.
Right.
To give it that, you know, golden color. And, you know, in the end, it didn't bake correctly. It was brittle. I couldn't get the peak through.
I wonder why.
Yeah, I wonder why, right? And it, I made a little, you know, I added an extra story, and it was a block. It was I baked a housing project and, like, public, you know, subsidized housing. It was just an awful thing. But, you know, my mother put it, of course, in the center of the table, which made it even worse. And my brother actually began to eat it. He came out and ate it. He ate a chunk of roof and then came back for some wall. And, you know, that little gesture turned my crummy Christmas into a great one. And that's really what the book's kind of about. All my holidays have always been really cruddy, except hidden inside is a perfect Christmas
right.
every time. I just don't necessarily see it at the time.
There's something you said in the beginning of that story that really struck home for me, that you said on the magazine cover or wherever you saw the picture, it said the recipe was foolproof. And if I remember something you had said, someone had referred to you as being foolish, and you figured if it was foolproof, a fool could do it. So if you were a fool, you could make the recipe. Did I get that right?
I mean, it's something like that, yeah. And that's what I felt. It was, I think it was Woman's Day. And you know, that was a dangerous line for me. That was a very dangerous line. I mean, I was a child who could destroy my mother's good revere ware by boiling water, you know, by letting it evaporate and then seizing the bottom of the pot to the burner. So
yeah, it warps.
We'll see if a fool can make this.
Have you done any gingerbread since?
I haven't done anything since. I mean, I cooked in 1989 when I moved to New York City. I made roast beef, and I had to tell people what it was. You know, like, it's okay, guys, it's roast beef. When you have to tell people it's roast beef, you need to not cook anymore.
Well, okay, that was then, now it's now. Has Christmas gotten better?
Well, the last story in the book is about how we've, you know, built a house and I'm domesticated now and I'm living in my sort of after. And right after getting a tree, which was about a week before Christmas, it was the day after we put the tree up, the house flooded. And, you know, our next-door neighbor helped save us. And what she did was simple. You know, she cleaned up the water and brought sandwiches, but it was the way she did it that made me feel she had given me like a mason jar filled with liquid golden Christmas. You know, you just... From some grandmother's pantry shelf, the rarest substance in the world, just sprinkle, you know, drizzle a tablespoon on any bad day, and you'll have a perfect Christmas. That's what it felt like. So I feel like she did save me.
That was a great neighbor. Augustine, with great hesitation, happy holiday.
Thank you. You too. Take care.
You too. Augustine Burroughs' book is You'd Better Not Cry. Stories for Christmas. Mix that's us, we Americans, really shines. Every one of our cultures has its must-haves and strange family stamps on the holiday. Well, this year we opted for a Cuban glimpse of Christmas, and we've invited Chef Douglas Rodriguez to join us. Douglas, welcome.
Thank you, Lynn.
Now, for you, what is a Cuban Christmas?
Well, Cuban Christmas is typically celebrated on Christmas Eve, and I know I have a lot of childhood memories of huge parties in my house with the whole family. And I'm talking about extended family, like third cousins and, you know, uncles that only came over, you know, for special holidays, like creepy uncles, you know. And I can't remember one where the pig wasn't the center of the attention. And typically we eat at midnight and then all the kids stay awake and they open up all their gifts. So it's a long night celebration. And typically when the Cubans cook the pig, and granted, I lived in New York City for many of those childhood years.
Right.
So when we lived in New York City, that pig was roasted in the oven. And my mother wasn't a great cook. I mean, everything was well done. That pig was in the oven from like 10 o'clock in the morning till midnight. And it was, you know, practically sawdust by the time it came out of the oven. And if it wasn't for her good mojo sauce, it was kind of difficult to eat. But I have other childhood memories after being in Miami and doing the pig the more traditional way in the backyard where they dig the hole and they kind of smoke the pig underground.
Would this be a whole pig?
A whole pig, yeah.
Oh, my.
Because they're not you can't get one in an oven, right?
Right.
You know, the side dishes like rice and beans will probably be a second act to the pig. And then usually when you invite so many people, you know, you don't take the onus on yourself to prepare all the dishes, so you have them all bring something.
Now, Douglas, you sent us a menu. Could you walk us through it?
Yeah. I sent the, like, not-so-traditional Latin American Christmas Eve party, but, you know, where the pork is the star. I sent crab empanadas as an appetizer, some plantain chips and salsa as, like, a little appetizer also.
Right.
The pig recipe, black beans and rice, a plantain or a sweet banana side dish. But the most important thing is the marinade on the pork. And I want to kind of like walk you through the process of marinating the pork because you could choose different cuts. You could choose a boneless pork butt. You can choose a bone-in pork shoulder or even a ham, a fresh ham, which is a much bigger piece of meat.
Right, right.
But regardless, you got to soak it and marinate it for 24 hours. And the marinade is basically raw garlic, cilantro, oregano, cumin, vinegar, salt, pepper, and it's pureed in the blender, the marinade, and it's poured right over the pig. And traditionally, it's marinated for at least 24 hours. And then you take it out of the marinade, but you don't clean it off. You leave part of the marinade that's clinging to the protein, and you roast it with the clinging marinade on it. at a very slow roast, at a low temperature slow roast. It just falls right off the bone. It becomes very tender. The whole house begins to smell like the marinade and the... I'm getting hungry.
Yeah, I know.
Is it lunchtime, right? It's about that time.
I'm thinking...
Start talking about food. I can smell it. It's not... I can smell it right now.
It sounds utterly delicious. Now, the rest of this menu, I'm just looking, the black beans and the rice, for instance. Is there a classic way that you always do that?
Absolutely. And that recipe in there, if you notice the name on it, that's my mother's name. It's Gloria's Black Beans. It's a very traditional Cuban way of making the beans, and it's vegetarian. There's no animal product in the beans. It's made with roasted onions and roasted green peppers and a lot of olive oil. Pure virgin olive oil is the main flavoring of the beans. And I like the beans. I like to make a big batch, and I like to put them in the freezer in one-quart containers, and whenever I want to indulge and not wait, you know, cook beans for 2 hours, I always have that quart container and defrost it in the microwave. But those black beans, I mean, will make it anything delicious. You just put that on, you know, rice, and it's just a lot of flavor, and it's just delicious.
Oh, sounds fabulous. Now, what would be the traditional dessert?
Oh, we have so many wonderful Cuban desserts, but my favorite is called tres leches, which is a piece of regular Genoise cake, what a French would call a Genoise, which is
like a
cake with
like
folded
a
like egg whites.
Yeah.
Like exactly a sponge cake. Then after the sponge is cooked and becomes room temperature, they puncture holes in it and they pour a mixture of three different milks, which is the tres leches. It's evaporated milk, sweet condensed milk, and cream. And you do a mixture of the three milks and you pour it on top of the cake. The cake obviously becomes very soggy.
Right.
But the prize in there is the milky residue that, you know, is left in the pan. It's one of the most delicious traditional Cuban desserts I can think of.
This sounds wonderful. Well, a very Merry Christmas to you, sir.
Feliz Navidad. Thank you for having me on the show, Lynn.
Gracias.
I want to wish you a Merry Christmas from the bottom of my heart. I'm in the studio, baby.
Oh, boy.
My second career. I'm ready to rock and roll.
Thank you.
Gracias a ti.
Take care.
Thank you, Lynn.
Among Chef Douglas Rodriguez's restaurants is Ama de Cuba in Philadelphia. The very generous Mr. Rodriguez left us with a full menu of recipes to have our very own Cuban feast this year. You can find it all, you know where, on the website, splendidtable.org. Now, also on the website, you're going to find the Splendid Table store where you can find products related to cooking and baking.
Feliz Navidad! Feliz Navidad! Feliz Navidad! Espero años de felicidad! Feliz Navidad, Feliz Navidad, Feliz Navidad, prospero año y felicidad. Feliz Navidad.
Well, it's time for us to talk. Now, you can get to us at 800-537-5252 or send us an email. Go to splendidtable.org. Let's see. Who is calling? We have Deborah from Raleigh on the phone. Deborah, what do you want to talk about?
Hey, Liz. Nice to talk to you. I had a comment and a question, maybe.
Sure.
My comment was that I have two sons, and I'm a Whole Foods cook, and growing up, my children were very involved in my kitchen.
Yeah.
So I'm wanted to comment that boys want their moms and their grandma's recipes just as much as girls do. They just don't ask for them in that kind of a way. It's kind of a weird thing. My kids, one lives in China, one is stateside, but they will call me and say, Mom, I've got this fish. I don't know what it is. I've got these fish. You know what I'm saying?
And yeah.
Really wanting to know all this stuff, and I'm writing them both a book. That's kind of like from like water for chocolate, that type of thing, about their lives and what they ate when they were five and throwing those recipes in. And
what a great idea.
Yeah. And I'm getting to the point where I've really written a lot. It's taken me about 2 years. They don't know about these books yet.
And they may now.
Well, they may now. That's right. I'm getting to the Feast of the Seven Fishes, which is their most favorite thing in their lives.
Is this your Christmas Eve tradition?
Yes, ma'am, it is. You know about it, right?
Yes, I do. Yes, I do.
You totally lived it, I'm sure.
You know, only to a point. It's interesting. Although my family's Italian on both sides, and we always had seafood on Christmas Eve, we did not have that because my mother didn't like fish. So it's really interesting that the Christmas Eve meal, if you want me to be totally honest, it was extremely simple. And what I remember most vividly was hot cocoa with marshmallows.
Oh, my goodness.
But the tradition of the seven fishes, and in some families and in some cultures, it's 13 fishes.
Sometimes it's three. It depends upon what I feel like.
Yeah.
And if I'm traveling, like this year I will be traveling and I'll do the seven fishes. But it varies. It varies from, you know, what part of the country I'm cooking in, you know.
So will the boys get the young men, will they get the books this year?
They're big, hairy men at this point. They're 29 and 30.
Oh, my.
You know, Lynn, I don't know. It's funny because I don't see an end of the book. You know what I mean? I'm at their high school years now talking about, you know, embarrassing them about their girlfriends and what they did when they were 16 and 17, and writing my memories and adding the recipes. I don't know when they'll get them. I'm still writing about them. I'm still adding recipes. So it's kind of a cool thing. And I just wanted to encourage other moms to do that because boys need it.
Yeah.
And sometimes they don't get it. I mean, sometimes we don't, I don't know, we don't look at our boys as our girls and hand things down that way. And I just, that was my comment, really. But
yeah,
I do have a question.
All right, now for your question.
Well, you know, okay, the seven fishes, and I have to, my maiden name is Kennedy, so I learned all this from my husband's family, the Giallinellos.
Uh-huh, okay.
Very Italian. And they were not very forthcoming with their recipes. They made me hang out in the kitchen and watch. They wouldn't tell me anything. So I am really good at everything except the calamari.
Now, what's your problem with the calamari, the squid?
It's rubbery. I've tried it many different ways, and I'm not sure. You know, I've stuffed it. I've had it cold in salad.
Mm-hmm.
I really like it deep fried.
Well, I've got the solution for you. Okay.
Thank you.
This is, when we're getting fancy, we could say this is a morceau de gâteau, French for this is a piece of cake.
Okay, cool. I'm ready.
Here's the deal with squid. You either cook it for seconds or you cook it for a minimum of 45 minutes at a very, very, very gentle simmer. And the idea is that it turns to rubber if you try to cook it too fast or you try to cook it for too short a time. And then when you cook it for seconds, now, for instance, if you're going to put it in a salad, you drop it into barely bubbling liquid literally for a few seconds and pull it out immediately. If you're deep frying it, the real key is to have that oil at 375 and make sure
it's... So get a thermometer.
You've got to have a thermometer. So just think about this. Seconds or for, you know, when you're stuffing it and you're cooking it, let it have some liquid. You know, I would put in a little bit of a red wine tomato sauce, and I used to stuff it with, I'd stuff the body, you know, with a mixture of cheese and greens and that kind of thing. And then I'd put it in the oven and cover it and let it cook very gently with that sauce and then uncover it at the last minute. But treat it as though it's a tough piece of meat. That's what you want to do. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. It's all sort of muscular tissue. You know, there's no marbling in a squid. So
you know the code. Thank you so much.
Have a great holiday.
And you too.
I shall with my cocoa and my marshmallows. I'll think of you on Christmas Eve.
Think of me with bubbling cauldrons of marinara and shrimp and, you know.
You got it. You got it.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
You are welcome, Deborah. Take care. Hey, remember, you can reach us 24/7. 800-537-5252, or hit the website, splendidtable.org. Well, I have got this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question is, where is the Christmas pickle celebrated? Now, we're going to be back with that answer in a moment, and we're going to be taking more of your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Now, we're going to be getting back to your calls and questions in a moment. You can join us at 800-537-5252 or get to us online via splendidtable.org. But first, I have got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Well, the question was, where is the Christmas pickle celebrated? Well, a little known fact is that the Christmas pickle capital of the world is Berrien Springs, Michigan. Every December, there is Pickle Fest, with a pickle parade led by the Grand Dillmeister. Now, that's when you eat deep-fried chocolate pickles, join in games like Pickle Smash and Pickle Fling. Why, may you wonder, a Christmas pickle? Why a little town in Michigan? And why bother? Well, the Christmas pickle started with an imaginary storyteller. Evidently, in the 1300s, two little boys were trapped in a pickle barrel. St. Nicholas saved them. And for reasons unknown to anyone, the Germans started hiding pickles in their Christmas trees. The lucky child who found the pickle got an extra gift. Except none of the story is true. It's a legend. Well, what is true is Germany does produce pickle Christmas ornaments. So why the little town in Michigan and why bother? Well, maybe because Picklefest is such a delightfully innocent and funny idea. And it's such a great way for a small town to celebrate the holidays. Well, happy Picklefest, Berrien Springs. And now, back to the phones and the emails. You can reach us, 800-537-5252, or go online, splendidtable.org. Well, Jeff is calling from Atlanta. Jeff, hi. What do you want to talk about?
Well, I've got a classic Christmas dinner that's passed along from my English grandmother.
Right.
Which consists of roast beef, roast potatoes, and Yorkshire pudding.
Oh, it sounds so good.
Well, it is good. And we've passed it along to our own kids as well. But somewhere along the line, when my mother took over the making of Yorkshire pudding,
right,
she has lost her touch because they started out as these beautiful, floaty popovers.
Right.
With a hollow center and a crisp outside. They're just wonderful with gravy.
Yeah.
And in the last 5 or 10 years, they've turned into hockey pucks, and they're not good anymore.
Hmm.
Grandma has lost her touch.
I wonder, has Grandma lost her touch, or have some other things changed?
Well, it's hard to say, but we've experimented with a number of different ways of making them, and somehow they just never arise the way they used to.
Because this is what I'm wondering. Has your family always lived in Atlanta?
No, we used to live in Los Angeles.
Aha. Okay. Did the Yorkshire pudding, this is a mystery, did the Yorkshire pudding change when you moved to Atlanta?
You know, I think it did. I never thought of that. I never thought of Yorkshire pudding as being geographic.
In all modesty, I have to say, is the Sherlock Holmes of recipes.
Wow.
You know what? The flour is different where you're living now. You see, in the South, because the South is a place where you make biscuits, by tradition, it's a much softer flour that you're using probably. It has less protein in it. And you were probably using the equivalent of an all-purpose flour in Los Angeles. The all-purpose flour where you live now may have less protein. Now, if you look for a national brand like Gold Medal or Pillsbury, okay, and use their all-purpose, you will probably be okay, or even use bread flour, because what Yorkshire pudding is basically flour, eggs, and salt and milk, right?
That's it.
And it's a batter that you beat like crazy, right? And then you put it in these hot pan juices, essentially the fat from the meat, and you put it in a really hot oven and it puffs up. It's just like a popover. It's the same thing. Well, you've got to have some protein structure, some elasticity in that flour so it holds its shape. Otherwise, you get lead sinkers.
I always thought it had to do with temperature, and I've tried hot ovens, and I've had a little better luck with it, but it never dawned on me that
Hot oven's going to help it a lot. And, of course, do use an oven thermometer, because every oven in the United States is incorrect just about. But the reality is it's probably your flour.
That's great.
Trust the tradition.
I'm looking forward to Great Yorkshire Pudding.
Oh, yeah. And it's, oh, boy, it is such a treat. That whole meal is such a treat.
I wish I could convince my wife to have it more than once a year.
Yeah, I know. It's not the healthiest thing in the world. But, oh, it's you have me fantasizing. I can just see that roast beef standing there right now.
Well, my mom will be proud if I can make it the proper way.
It's not your mom losing her touch. Don't let her think that for one second.
I've already accused her of that.
No, take that back.
I will.
Take that back. You just tell her geography and flour milling is playing against her. That's all.
That's great.
Have a wonderful holiday.
You too.
Take care, Jeff.
Bye.
Call us, 800-537-5252. We have Janice calling from St. Louis. Janice, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. Thanks so much for taking my call.
You are welcome.
My husband and I just moved into our first house, and I've been graciously awarded the task of having Christmas Eve dinner for his family.
Isn't that just swell?
It is. So I'm very excited. And a few weeks back, I was given 6 bone-in breasts of wild duck.
Oh, wow.
Of course, that's not enough for everyone.
How many people are you having?
I have 8 adults and 3 children.
Okay. All right.
So I would... Everyone in the family is obviously very excited about the prospect of wild duck.
Right.
And so I'd like a way to incorporate that into the meal, and I was trying to find a way to use the duck as part of a stuffing for, like, Cornish hens.
Oh, no. No.
I didn't know what to do. And
yeah, no, I hear you. But, you know, when you have duck breast, you don't want to mix that up with anything.
Okay.
It's too fabulous to mix it up.
Okay.
Okay, here's the deal with the duck breast. There are 2 ways you can cook a duck breast.
Uh-huh.
One is, especially with wild duck, you do a very light marinade or a rub on it, if you choose, and you cook it low and slow.
Okay.
And you cook it until it is quite pink, and then you thinly, thinly slice it across the grain, which in so many words, the duck is like the breast is like a long oval.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. You would remove it from the bone once it's cooked, and then you would slice it crossways across that oval into thin slices at a slant.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you slice it that way, you're slicing across the grain and you're automatically tenderizing the duck.
Okay.
The other way you do it is that you do a quick browning in a skillet, okay, and then you cook it over fairly fast heat.
Okay.
I like the low and slow approach because it gives you more control. And you want to cook it to an internal temperature of about 135 to 140, and then you give it a nice rest. And then you can thin slice it. But this is what I would do it to celebrate the duck and make sure everybody had a nice taste of it.
Mm-hmm.
Why not make it part of a first course salad? It's a classic way of serving duck breast.
Oh, that sounds great.
Now, this is what you do. You would get some nice salad greens. And since the breast has such a nice, rich, good flavor, I'd get greens that have a little tartness to them.
Okay.
You could do curly endive. When you spend more money for curly endive and they grow it a little differently, they call it frisée. Okay? And then if you want to splurge, you could get mosh, which is a mild green. But you could do this with bib lettuce. You would cut them into thin shreds. You just roll up the leaves and cut them.
Mm-hmm.
You roll them up like cigars.
Okay.
Slice them across, and you get what's called a chiffonade. Looks really pretty. Do the duck breasts ahead. Do them earlier in the day.
Mm-hmm.
Let them come to room temperature. Thin slice them. You want to keep them cool. You don't want to leave them out. But you don't have to serve them hot is my point.
Okay.
But what you would do is you'd save the pan drippings from the duck.
Okay.
And you take out, you're not going to probably have a lot of fat in there, all right?
Mm-hmm.
You'd salt and pepper the duck, by the way, to roast it, backing up a bit.
Salt
and pepper the duck. You might baste it with a bit of red wine, okay?
Okay.
Or a little bit of a sweeter wine, like a Madeira, all right? You see, something that you could do a hint of sweetness with the duck. Save those pan drippings. And then what you're going to do is you're going to put the salad on each person's plate. You can have some red onion rings in that. You can put in, some craisins, which are very nice and very festive for the holiday.
Yeah.
And then you would lay the duck slices over each person's portion, at least 3 thin slices, which would probably be more than enough.
Oh, sure.
Okay. And you could have extra on a plate on the side for people who want more of the breast. But then what you would do is you'd put the pan drippings on a burner and you'd pour in vinegar. Okay, wine vinegar, cider vinegar, sherry vinegar, and you'd boil that down, scraping up all the brown bits in the pan. You'd have some garlic in that pan.
Mm.
Okay. All right.
I'm liking what you're saying.
This is really tasty stuff. And then you'd stir in a little bit of oil. You're making a warm vinaigrette dressing. And you do this to your own taste.
Okay.
All right. And if you wanted to, there could be garlic in that. There could be shallot in that. You could have nuts that you sprinkle over the salad. And then the idea is that you have those salad plates all set up. You drizzle the warm dressing over the salad and out it goes.
That sounds absolutely amazing.
You could also bring it right to the table in a pitcher, warm, and just drizzle over everybody's plate.
Okay.
Okay? So you have the greens as the backdrop for a fairly generous amount of the duck breast, and you're off and running.
That sounds absolutely amazing.
I think you'll like it.
I can't wait.
Yeah, about 300, 325 on the duck breast, and then if you want to brown it, you can flip up the oven at the last moment.
Sounds great.
I think you're going to enjoy it. And how lucky.
Thank you so
and
much.
By the way, congratulations on the new house.
Thank you.
And
thank
may
you.
It be a place of great happiness for you and the family.
I'm sure it will be. Thank you so much.
You are welcome. Take care.
Have a Merry Christmas.
Thank you, ma'am.
Thanks.
You
bye,
too.
Liz.
Bye. All of these good questions today. Yeah, you're keeping me on my toes. Now, you know, everyone who works in food has their go-to people when they need a question answered. The books that get thumbed again and again. Well, some of my most thumbed volumes have been written by Mediterranean expert Paula Wolfert. So when I heard rumors that Paula was writing a book on the oldest continuously used cookware on the planet, I was there. Paula's book is Mediterranean Clay Pot Cooking, Traditional and Modern Recipes to Savor and Share. Paula, it's good to have you here.
Well, thank you.
What is the draw of clay for you?
Well, first you have to understand that it's a different method of cooking. And the flavor of food that's cooked in clay is sweeter. It takes away bitterness. I mean, there's so many attributes to cooking in clay, and it's the oldest method of cooking, and it would have stayed as the center, except that metal came along, and that became the idea of the rich, and the rich could afford it, and they don't break, so that became another aspect. Mm-hmm. But the draw of the pot is the recapturing of true flavor, and that's very much of what is today. The locavores, you know, everybody's talking about organic vegetables and fresh food. Well, clay fits right in there.
You know, the thing I wonder when you think about just the way you have to cook in clay, you point out that you must cook slowly.
Well, yes, that's true. And it improves flavor because you're stacking and you're slowly extrapolating all the taste. And yet the things are holding themselves together because it's not fast cooking. It's not being crushed. And also, you know, there's less fat. You know, Lynn, correct my Italian on this, but do you know there's an Italian saying, and I'm going to say it in Italian, but you correct me after.
All right, please. Sure.
La salute e nella cotta. Health is in terracotta pot.
Yes.
So it you know, it's good for you.
But now, talking about good for you, though, whenever you mention cooking in clay, I think the first thing that comes to our minds is lead and possibility of lead glazes. What do we have to know about that?
You have to know a lot, but it's down to two words, lead check.
Lead
which
check?
You can buy at Amazon, or you can buy it in any of those hardware stores. And it's a little pencil, and it's only for glazed pots. Anything that's unglazed doesn't have lead. Secondly, anything that says for food use, it's put out by the USDA, the pots that come from abroad,
right,
have been checked for lead.
Okay. So, Paula, give us some idea of what kinds of foods lend themselves to being cooked in clay.
Well, the most famous is beans. I mean, beans turn sweet. Meat turns sweet. But when I say sweet, I don't mean sugar sweet. I mean they're no longer bitter or there's nothing harsh. Something happens to food when it's cooked in clay. I like to use the word coddling. In fact, my moment of revelation when I realized that cooking in clay was really different and really important and really wonderful to tell people about was when I just fried an egg. I did it side by side with my trusty metal omelet pan.
Right.
I put some eggs in my fry pan, and I put some eggs in a clay skillet. The difference was amazing. Within 2 minutes, the white of the egg in the metal pan spread out, made a little frizzle. It was nice. It's just like what you get in a diner.
Uh-huh.
And then in that other pan, the clay pan, the white swelled up and became almost bosomy, if you can imagine. And there was the yolk, runny and delicious and tender. There was a taste of truth in the egg. And I think it's the flavor of the clay. It's unique.
Paula, thanks so much for talking with us.
Oh, and thank you so much for having me.
Paula Wolford's book is Mediterranean Clay Pot Cooking, Traditional and Modern Recipes to Savor and Share. She has got a short rib recipe that is excellent the second day. So you can find stufado with beef and caramelized onions right on the website, splendidtable.org. Well, that's the show this week. Thanks for joining us. Remember, you can call us anytime. The number's 800-537-5252. From all of us here at the Splendid Table, have a fine holiday. And let me leave you with this thought from Jane Grigson. She said, "In my experience, clever food is not appreciated at Christmas. It makes the little ones cry and the old ones nervous." Splendid Table is produced by American Public Media. Now, you'll find information on nearly everything you heard here today on our website, splendidtable.org. Also at splendidtable.org is the Splendid Table store, where you can find products related to cooking and baking. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Judy Boudreau. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Sarah Lear and Roger Miller. Our managing producer is Sally Swift. We'll be back next week. You have a lovely holiday, and thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.